The relationship between people and wolves goes way back, and really that's where our relationship with dogs came from. But wolves in the wild are still there, and still wild, and the relationship is still there, isn't it? Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Steve Heimel. Today it's Nick Jans, who used to hunt wolves and then got to know one quite well. You can call Mouse toll-free statewide, 1-800-478-8255, a local call on Anchorage at 550-8422. Everybody's got an opinion on Romeo. Email talk@alaskapublic.org. A wolf called Romeo.
Today's program is underwritten in part by
First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's business dreams grow for more than 90 years. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Where can you see more than 1,000 entertainers, from Alaska Native dancers to dinosaurs? The Alaska State Fair. This year, everyone attending the fair can enjoy music free with fair admission, like Riders in the Sky, Young Dubliners, Redhead Express, Savannah Jack, Home Free, and Kentucky Lineman. Learn more at thealaskastatefair.org. Music, fair food, and good time fun. It's what the Alaska State Fair is all about. This message sponsored by the Alaska State Fair. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
I guess you call Nick Jans a nature writer, but he might object to that. I'm not sure. He wrote The Grizzly Maze, for instance, so he sort of turned to wildlife in recent years. And he has now written one called A Wolf Called Romeo. And he certainly had plenty of personal acquaintance with that particular wolf. So I'd like to introduce right now, by digital link in Juneau, Nick Jans. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Nick.
Hi, Steve. Happy to be here.
So do you mind being called, what are you, an outdoor writer, a travel writer, a writer on the make? What are you?
A writer on the make.
I like that.
Well,
every writer's on the make, man.
Well, I'd have to say, but I guess I look at myself as I'm just a writer. And what I mean by that is that the words, the language that I use to tell the story is more important than the story itself, strange as that may sound. Some writers use words as a mere convenience. You know, they're just something that conveys meaning. But I believe that meaning is contained in the sounds and shapes of words, and everything that I write is meant to be read aloud. And I hear Shakespeare and Rudyard Kipling at my shoulder nudging me and directing me here and there, I suppose. I don't mean that in some self-aggrandizing way, because there's no way you can keep up with those guys. But I am trying to write in the most complicated way I know, which is very, very simply and in the rhythms of conversational speech.
It's amazing how you can write a really elegant, eloquent paragraph and then read it out loud and realize, oh, my God, is this really?
Oh, yeah, and you have to do that. I mean, everything that I write, I edit by reading it aloud, not once, but many times.
Well, maybe we can just briefly, the story of Romeo, for those who don't know it, and probably almost everyone listening does, but some probably do not, is essentially in the Mendenhall Valley, a large black wolf shows up and starts socializing with dogs, and with no harmful intent of any sort. And you were one of the people who discovered this about this wolf. And then the adventure continued for a number of years and did not end well. And so, in a sense, the book, A Wolf Called Romeo, then is a tragedy, because we know how it comes out, you know, from the very beginning.
Right.
And I know it's been a difficult thing for you to write, but maybe you could pick out a paragraph and just read some out loud and sweep us up in it right now.
Okay. Well, this comes from the prologue. In a few heartbeats, the wolf had closed the distance to 40 yards. He stood stiff-legged, tail raised above his back, his unblinking stare fixed on us, a dominant posture, less than reassuring. Then, with a moaning whimper, our lab Dakota suddenly wrenched free of the two fingers I'd hooked through her collar and bounded straight at the wolf. A tone of desperation sharpening her voice, Sherry called again and again, but there was no stopping that dog. The lab skidded to a stop several body lengths short of contact and stood tall, her own tail straight out, and as we watched, mouths open, the wolf lowered his to match. With the two so close, I had my first clear idea of just how large the wolf really was. He towered over Dakota, more than double her weight. Just his head and neck matched the size of her torso. 120 pounds, I figured, maybe more. The wolf stepped stiff-legged toward Dakota, and she answered. If she heard our calls, she gave no sign. She was locked on and intent, but utterly silent, not at all her normal happy lab self. She seemed half hypnotized. She and the wolf regarded each other as if each were glimpsing an almost forgotten face and trying to remember. This was one of those moments when time seems to hold its breath. I lifted my camera and snapped off a single frame. As if that tiny click had been a finger snap, the world began to move again. The wolf's stance altered. Ears perked high and held narrow, he bounded forward a body length, bowed on his forelegs, then leaned back and lifted a paw. Dakota sidled closer and circled, her tail still straight out. The eyes of each were locked on the other. With their noses a foot apart, I pressed the shutter once more. Again, the sound seemed to break a spell. Dakota heard Sherry's voice at last and bounded back toward us, turning her back, at least for now, on whatever call of the wild she'd just heard. We watched for long minutes with Dakota softly whining at her sides, staring toward the dark, handsome stranger who stood staring our way and whining back. A high-pitched keening that filled the silence. Half-stunned, Sherry and I murmured back and forth, wondering at what we'd seen and what it meant.
Thanks. We're talking with Nick Jans, author of A Wolf Called Romeo. So it's been out how long now?
Came out July 1.
And you've obviously already done some of these shows. What kind of reaction do people have to it?
You know, I can't remember ever being repeatedly thanked for writing a book. And it's very, very humbling to have people do that. Not once, not twice, but I mean, pretty much I get several emails a week from total strangers who are saying just that. And it's, I think there's some visceral connection with this story that people have, and I sort of have, I think, have tapped into the thing that was, that attracted me to it, which is just this incredible emotional tie that so many of us have to the wild. You know, it's the essence of Alaska, and it's also an animal story, and it's all kinds of things. But to me, it's extremely, extremely personal, of course. And it was a difficult story to write for that reason, and it was also a difficult story to write technically.
I'll have to say that, you know, as a journalist, of course, I've known this story all along. Followed it a bit and was somewhat dismissive. Mm-hmm. My feeling was, well, maybe this is a dog. They think it's a wolf or, there's some really bad habituation going on here. This is not going to end well. And on like that, but it went on for a number of years.
Well, that's the point. You can say, you can offer this up as a cautionary tale of wildlife-human contact gone wrong, and oh, I told you so. Consider this, though. Okay, as you've alluded, the story doesn't end well, and Romeo is shot by two poachers. But it was in his eighth year, at least, if not more. We know that because he showed up as a full-grown adult, so it was at least in his second year at the time he showed up, and he stayed for 6 years. One study in Denali Park, we're talking about wolves that do not step outside of the park. The average lifespan of a Denali Park wolf in that study was 3 years. Okay, this wolf was on his way to being nine. And I don't know how tripling that wild rate, you know, becomes a cautionary tale. To me, it's some sort of a success story and sort of a model for wildlife management, for interspecies tolerance, for all kinds of things. And it took a lot of doing on a lot of people's parts and agencies' parts and the wolf's part to make it happen. And it was really remarkable for that reason. I mean, you have a 120-pound wolf. He's not in a preserve. He's not behind a fence. He's hopscotching through people's backyards to play with wiener dogs and stuff like that. And this happens again and again and again. And there's hundreds and hundreds of close human and dog contacts a month sometimes. And nothing happens. And you kept waiting for that knife to drop, for something really bad to happen, you know, probably human induced. And the remarkable part of the story is that it didn't for so long. And, you know, I think about it all the time. It's a haunting thing because you wonder, what could we have done differently? How could it have been different? We tried to scare the wolf away and he just came back. And he'd just show up somewhere else, and then he'd be back over by our place. And I'm talking about throwing snowballs at him, waving ski poles, running at him, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. It didn't make any difference. He knew where he wanted to be. He chose his territory and just happened to be right up against us. And it was up to us to react. And by us, I mean the city of Juneau. Because this isn't my story. This is the city of Juneau's story, truly. I just happened to be a person who was in a position to tell it.
Yeah, you and there was Joel Bennett was a very important part of the story, I think.
Yes, and Harry Robinson also, who spent more time with the wolf than anybody else, really developed what I am positive was a true friendship between not just the wolf and his dog, but between the wolf and himself. And the reason I'm pretty sure of that was because the same thing happened with me, and I had far less contact, where the wolf would come trotting over to see me whether I had a dog or not, and would give the sort of affable greetings that you'd expect from, you know, your neighbor's dog that you knew.
And your reaction then was to try and keep a distance, right?
Yeah, and, you know, it was so tough because, I mean, we lived right on the edge of the lake. The border between our property and the Tongass National Forest was 20 feet from our back door, okay? So the wolf was sometimes sitting right in our yards. We couldn't drive away. We couldn't leave him behind. We literally had a wolf at our door on and off for 6 years. And he'd be sitting out there on the ice in the morning with his tail curled over his toes waiting for us to let our dogs out. And, you know, you could live under siege, you could do what you wanted to. But the thing is, when we pulled back, other people just stepped forward. And after a while, you thought, well, what's the point? And still you're trying to set some sort of a good example. And it was just one of those things where there wasn't really a good way out for anybody. And not only that, again, I don't think that this is something gone wrong. Just because of the length of its duration. I mean, it went on and on for years, and we got to know a wild wolf as an individual, as a sentient being. And he wasn't just any wolf. He was incredibly bright. He had a really, really interesting personality. He was very playful. You could see him working things out. I would say he was a combination of a young Arnold Schwarzenegger and a young Albert Einstein of wolves. He had it all.
A wolf called Romeo. And Romeo, really, because it wasn't really a mating kind of thing, it didn't appear, right? It was more of a playing kind of thing with dogs.
It was. And, you know, it was just nuts. Okay, you have a 120-pound male intact wolf. It was very clear. You know, that he had his whole package there. And yet he seemed so submissive and tolerant because normally a wolf like that would definitely have a pack of his own because size matters. I'm talking about like physical size in the wolf world. Big wolves trump smaller wolves. It's real simple. And he could have easily been a dominant male in a big, successful hunting pack. And instead, there he is by himself. And the question was, why? there were all sorts of interesting survival choices and lifestyle choices that this wolf made and didn't make. And that's what's so remarkable about him, was this interaction. And then you realize that, well, heck, this stuff must have happened before. Because how else did we end up with the muted and shaped souls of wolves lying at our feet that we call our best friend? They came from somewhere. You know, 99.98% genetically identical, Canis familiaris and Canis lupus.
Well, you're familiar, of course, with Gordon Haber's work. You probably knew Gordon.
Oh, yeah. No, Gordon. Bless him.
And he researched extensively behavior through observation. And,
oh, yeah.
And what he was, first off, he didn't like to say pack. He liked to say family.
Right.
And then he talked about even traditions.
Mm-hmm.
And he showed how much of the lifespan of a wolf is taken up with learning. In other words, it's a huge investment that the animal is making in learning.
Right.
And so here you have a wolf that really is kind of young when you first get to know it. So it could certainly be argued, don't you think, Nick, that this was an abnormal situation? Well, no, it was an abnormal situation, but I mean biologically way out of the norm.
Well, again, I don't know how abnormal. Obviously, it was quite not usual, but again, consider that we've had dogs lying at our feet and by our fires for at least tens of thousands of years. They keep pushing the clock back. And we've had close ties with wolves before. And I think Mother Nature loves to roll the dice. And this wolf, pretty remarkable animal, was just one expression of what a wolf might be. And he wasn't like any other wolf. He was a wolf. And yet he was different. There was no doubt about it. And I think I had conversations with Gordon about him, and Gordon was down here and just happened to not be lucky enough to see him. It was a rainy, slushy day out in the lake, and he put in a little bit of time, but it was bad going, and so he didn't see the wolf. But he was intrigued as well. And I totally agree with Gordon's observations. You have to, again, think about dogs. See, would you say that a dog is capable of love?
Yeah, I would.
Okay, so where did dogs get that? They got that from wolves. And one of the things that was really intriguing was getting to watch this wolf interact with dogs and seeing where they were the same and where they were different. And if you understand dog language, you understand a lot of wolf language already. The only difference is that a wolf is more intelligent, more physically talented, and pretty much is just an uber dog. So whatever you could find in a really, really bright, super athletic dog, you have at times a couple of factors in a wolf. And so I would argue that a wolf might have even more emotional complexity than a dog does, and all shades and nuances of behavior that we normally would not attribute to animals. And a lot of people are going to be dismissive of this. They'll say, oh, crap, you know, there you go. It's touchy-feely stuff. But I've shot more wolves than most people have seen, and I came to where I am the hard way. It was not at all an easy path. I'm not some touchy-feely guy. I've looked at wolf skulls and tried to determine their age and their lives by, you know, how beat up their teeth were and how tall their sagittal crests were and all that stuff. Wolves that I killed, and I'm not proud of that right now because, you know, it's just something that you do. You know, it's from another life and another time. But it got me to this spot. But I saw so many wolves in the wild, and this wolf seemed to just, well, the main thing about him is that he was visible. You could see him, you could watch him, and you could get to know him. And not even Gordon Haber, with all his incredible long contact time had an opportunity like this. And I really wish Gordon had had the opportunity to have spent some time around Romeo and gotten to know him to see what he had to think about it.
Well, I'm going to pound out the phone number here, 1-800-478-8255, 478-TALK, statewide, toll-free, a local call from Anchorage at 550-8422, email talk at alaskapublic.org. Our subject is Coexisting with Wildlife, and Nick Jans is our author by Digital Link from Juno. He wrote A Wolf Called Romeo. He also wrote The Grizzly Maze, which you may remember, and we'll probably depart into that territory. But Nick, if you're ready, I want to start with the calls.
Sure.
All right.
Let it rip.
All right. We'll go down to Bob, joins the program from Prince of Wales Island, where there are some wolves.
Oh, yeah, there are. Hi, Bob.
Hello, how are you? Sir, I don't remember your name that wrote the book about the wolf in Juneau. I live on Prince of Wales Island. I get to deal with wolves. But I'm a fan of Muttleys. Personally, and according to some of the books I have, Before the Dawn is one of them, Muttleys and peoples have been co-evolutionary. And there's even been biological changes in canids to reflect that. One of which is Homo saps, we are primates, we are facially oriented. Dog eyes have actually gotten wider whites from having to deal with us for the last 50,000 years. Now, I don't know if you've read the book, A Wolf in the Den. The man talks about the relationship between dogs and people, but the subtext is, who drove whose evolution? You know, did the Muttleys drive ours from moving in with our campfires, or we drive theirs by letting them in?
It's a real interesting point. It's a real interesting point. I think that's very well taken. It is a give and take deal, and I think most dog wolf behaviorists, people who study that, would totally agree. There's a study by a Romanian researcher that I detail in the book. I can't pronounce her name, so I won't try. She did a very interesting experiment with wolves that had been, of course, captive raised, and bright dogs that were with their handlers, and put them in problem-solving situations. And what she discovered was this sort of change that you hypothesized there, Bob, and which I think is right on, that dogs looked to people to help them solve the problem, and wolves looked only to themselves, even when they were with a handler they liked. They didn't solve problems the same way, and obviously they changed. And yeah, our history is between canids and people is so close and so remarkable. It's unlike anything on the planet.
It seems extremely unlikely that there wouldn't have been relationships at times developed between wolves and humans in terms of hunting. Hunting together, because wolves have advantages and humans have advantages, and sometimes they just had to have worked together. I mean, man and dog worked together.
Oh, sure. And I think it might have happened by accident. It probably happened all kinds of ways. And I've had interactions that were very interesting with totally wild wolves. I'm not talking about ones that are sort of habituated to people's presence, but way off in the Brooks Range, where wolves are clearly interacting with you, and not just in some wary way. And you can see things starting to happen. I had a young wolf, not a pup by any means, trot up to me, grab a stick like the kind a lab would have, and shake it back and forth and parade around. And you could tell that he was trying to get something going. It was a gesture of play. It was an invitation. And you just look at that and you go, son of a gun, you know, because he didn't learn that. That's something that somehow our two species just have this connection, and it's no accident that we end up with dogs. And this wolf is a lens to look at that whole process, and also to look at wolves as they are, by what this wolf was, what Romeo was, and what he wasn't.
You know, when my wife Johanna read this book, and she, I mean, it was like the advanced copy, not for resale, you know, just handed it to her, and she glommed onto it immediately and devoured it. And we had just seen the movie 12 Years a Slave, and she said, this is the same thing. This is, you don't get this type of expression unless there's been some trial and some justice has been denied and somebody has nothing left they can do about it except write a book.
Well, yes and no, because I, you know, to me, Romeo's killers don't matter for much to me at all. You know, you can get bitter about that stuff. It doesn't solve anything. And all I can say is,
well, if it wasn't Peacock and Myers, it could have been somebody else. I mean, there was a certain attitude, and I've heard that attitude when people want to talk about Timothy Treadwell. You know, I've heard that attitude when people want to talk about Into the Wild. You know, that a large anger and resentment is brought out by the idea of cuddling up too close to nature.
Right. And I'd like to know where that anger and resentment comes from. It's kind of weird because, see, you could go hang gliding off the Himalayas and people would just think that you're some crazy dude, right? You can do all kinds of reckless things and be thought of in high regard. But let it be getting close to animals that can eat you. And we have this trigger that comes on. It happened to Tim Treadwell, and that's the thing we have with wolves, is there's this little voice in the back of our heads that say, what a fool, that thing will eat you. And they automatically deride whoever is trying to claim some sort of interspecies contact or bridging that gap. And it's just interesting to me because people bring that. They bring that to the experience. You know, and I think if Tim Treadwell had been any kind of a daredevil, a whitewater kayaker who went down the Ganges Gorge or something, people would have said, whoa, dude, he's pretty gnarly, and he died doing what he loved. And instead, people say, what an idiot, you know? And that's sort of germane to this case here, because there were a lot of people in Juneau. And not only that, but of course in Alaska, who really resent the idea that you might have a social relationship with a wild animal. It ain't fitting, just ain't fitting, ain't fitting, you know? And you say, well, why not? And they say, well, it just isn't, you know? And not only that, it can't be. And I said, well, you can be friends with a dog. Why can't you be friends with a wild animal? And there are so many examples of interspecies friendship between other species. They're documented now. It's not just YouTube videos. Okay, this real honest-to-gosh research about everything from a cat adopting a blind German shepherd and leading him around to a turtle and a pig to whatever. And to think that we're somehow out of the conversation, that we, this big-brained, clever hominid that we are, can't have relationships with wild animals when we have relationships with so many different species of quote unquote tame ones. Come on now.
You know, I'm thinking about you probably run into the work of Franz de Waals, the guy that works with bonobos.
I know what bonobos are, and I know plenty of stuff that's come up, but I can't attribute it directly to him.
Well, Duwals he actually, you can like his Facebook page, and then you get these shares from him about animal behavior that you hadn't looked at that way before. And it's very, very interesting finding intelligence and other characteristics that we, empathy, that we tend to attribute to only to humans. I'm finding, no, actually, they can figure this out. They can do that. And actually, there's a number of things, for instance, that there are apes that can do better with us, cognitive things. And nobody wants to look at that. And I think that somehow is tied in with this. I'm not sure exactly how, but one thing he said, I went to a lecture where he gave, and he said, Well, the problem with the Western paradigm about animals is that we think that we have an animal nature that we must keep contained, that our civilization is just a veneer on the outside, and inside is our evil animal nature. And he said, that's the thing we have to go after.
That's an interesting point. But, you know, you have to also think is the incredible fascination that we all have for the wild. And it can express itself in hunting. It can express itself in nature photography. It can express itself in just, you know, bird watching in your backyard. Is we're attracted to other living things. And that's what enriches our lives on this planet. And finding out where those boundaries are, I mean, it isn't like it's our life's work, but these opportunities just happen. I wasn't looking for a wolf. The wolf came to us. It came to the people of Juneau, and it came to all of us and profoundly affected many people in a real way. And, you know, if I didn't have the damn pictures from the years, I would think it must have been something I dreamed, because that wolf might as well have been a unicorn. He might as well have fallen from the sky like E.T. What the hell was he doing? And it was just this bemusing, astounding thing to look up and suddenly find yourself looking into the eyes of a tolerant, socially affable wild wolf from like 20 feet away. You know, one of the most remarkable experiences I had with him is not very dramatic. It was just being out in a late April day, and the sun was just beating down, and it was getting so warm so fast that you could hear winter collapsing all around you. And the wolf's curled up out there on the ice near the mouth of the Mendenhall River. And I'm lying 20 feet away with my head against my pack, and my dog, Gus, who is a retired seeing eye dog, had his head on my leg. And there we were. We all took a nap together, you know, and there's three species as intermingled and as, and in the case of wolves and humans, as conflicted as any on the planet, just sharing the warmth and the passing of another winter. You know, it was just profoundly moving.
And then you woke up and you were all still there.
And we were, and you get up and you ski off toward the house, you know.
Go about your business.
Only a half mile away, and the wolf just sits there and looks at you, and you wonder what's going on in his head.
As Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, Alaska's pipeline to the future, delivering oil today, sustaining operations for tomorrow.
And by
Nana Regional Corporation and Tech Alaska, celebrating 25 years of resource development and partnership at the Red Dog Mine. Check the status of your permanent fund dividend application at pfd.alaska.gov. August 31st is the deadline for contributing to a college savings plan and to add or change charitable contributions. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Our guest is Nick Jans, author of A Wolf Called Romeo. He joins us by digital link from our member station KTOO in Juneau. But he's about to come into Anchorage and sign some books. And here now we test your professionalism here as to whether you can tell people when and where you're going to be signing books, Nick.
Well, that's not a test of professionalism, but of my addled memory.
I knew it. Good.
Oh yeah, no, I can definitely come up with some. Let me think here. Stall. Now I'm going to be at Barnes & Noble in Anchorage at 6 p.m. on the 28th, and that's my only real presentation in town where I'm actually showing a slideshow and doing a reading and taking questions and answers and stuff.
Oh, good. You're going to bring your slides. That's great.
Oh yeah. No,
I guess they aren't really slides anymore, are they?
Well, they still are to me, by God. You know, we still call records records,
I
you know,
do.
Even though So, okay. So, anyway, the second one is at Fireside Books out in Palmer at 11 a.m., and I'll be there for at least a couple hours. Of course, it's coinciding with the fair and all that traffic out there. So that's on the 29th, 11 a.m., and the next day, the 30th, I'll be signing at the DeBar Road Costco at 1 p.m.
Oh, wow.
And that's a new one for me. But Costco,
I've never seen anybody sign books at Costco.
Oh, they do. Costco just picked up the book nationally, which is a new one for me, because normally I'm trying to figure out what to do with a garage full of books. In this case, Costco helped Houghton Mifflin figure out what to do with some books.
Wow, so yeah. No. Congratulations on that, Nick Jans.
well, thanks. You know, it's of course you want some level of commercial success for a book that you write, because after all, it's what I do for a living full time. I don't have a safety net particularly. But what I will say is that more important to me is, and more humbling, is being able to tell this story, because as long as somebody knows this story, Romeo's still alive, you know?
You don't live in the Mendenhall Valley anymore.
No.
You wanted to get to someplace wilder.
Yeah.
And you found conditions, circumstances allowed you to. But is it related in any way at all to the fact that Romeo is no longer there, that part of the wild is no longer there?
No, it's not like that. It was just time to get back to the Alaska I came here for in the first place. I remember I spent my first 20 years way off the grid in Northwest Arctic Alaska in the Kobuk Valley. And it was time to get back to something like that. So we bought a place out the road in Haines, as they say, out near Porcupine Crossing. And to prove that we found the right place, my wife Sherry was pedaling her bike to the mailbox a half mile away 2 weeks ago, and heard a big rustle in the brush and a crash, and looked sideways, and there 5 feet from her, incoming, was a female grizzly in a cup. Like right there, close enough to touch. And our little hound who was with her slipped its collar, got the leash tangled around the bike, stopping Sherry cold, and charged straight into the middle of these bears, the first bears she'd ever been around, and sent them packing, and came back after much
hoot. Sent them packing?
Oh, man. She, we're talking about a 30-pound by-the-side-of-the-road rescue from North Central Florida. The little coonhound shrunk down to miniature size and just going straight into the face of the bears. And you hear this crashing and hound yodeling and hoo-ha going off into the cottonwoods. And Sherry's, of course, terrorized that, you know, the dog is mangled and dead and everything. And she's trying to figure out how to go looking for the dog without, engaging the bears again. And down our drive comes trotting the hound as if looking very satisfied. She'd had the bears right where she wanted them.
Whoa.
Yeah. So that was pretty recent. And 2 days later, I went back to the outhouse with bear spray in my back pocket, of course, and found my toilet paper had been disrespected by several large canine teeth.
Oh. Yow. Okay, Nick Jans is with us, and let's go up to Fairbanks. And Pat, welcome to Talk of Alaska, Pat.
Yeah, thank you. Nick, this is Pat Valkenburg. I met you many years ago when Tim Longhorn and I passed through Ambler on a snow machine trip. I don't know if you remember that.
I do remember it. You guys were nuts. You were heading off into the middle of nowhere. I mean, in a good way.
Yeah,
we
had a big trip up through Anaktuvik. But anyway, I spent a couple of years as deputy commissioner in Juneau, and that was right towards the end of Romeo's reign there. And I, like you, I was really fascinated by Romeo for many of the same reasons that you have touched on here, just our relationship with animals and the unusual nature of the wolf and that sort of thing. One of the things, there were some really humorous aspects to it, too. Romeo, obviously, as you mentioned, was pretty intelligent and got to recognize fish and game employees who were coming out there to supposedly condition him to stay away from people. And all they managed to do is teach him to recognize the difference between fish and game employees and his friends.
Oh, yeah. So, no, I remember Neil Barton, saying, well, the wolf was definitely dissuaded. Well, what he did is he learned what Neil looked like.
Yeah, right. That's right. But, you know, one of the real unanswered questions for me about the whole Romeo situation was how Romeo made a living. A wolf needs something like 5 to 7 pounds of meat per day. And I was never sure whether people were feeding Romeo or if he was making kills on his own. Did you ever figure that out?
Well, I picked apart dozens and dozens and dozens of his scats over the years. Every time I found a wolf scat, I kicked it apart to see what was in it. I wish I'd been more systematic. But here was the deal, what I figured out is that he became a small game specialist, and he was really good at it, and he was in a no-competition area because no other wolves were going to come down and hang around in Dredge Lakes. So he had access to beavers. There was a pretty large population of snowshoe hares for at least a couple years there. He ate microteens of all sorts, like popcorn. I mean, sometimes there was all these little bones, you know, from voles and mice. And we had big eruptions of them again some years. He ate porcupines with great skill, and you'd find these peeled out rinds, and porcupines are super abundant up there. There was deer hair.
You gotta tell me about the peeled out rinds. That's just too good.
Okay,
to pass.
Actually, Dave Person was who was, of course, a very good research biologist for ADFG down in Prince of Wales brought that to light to me. I said, what the hell? I keep on finding these peeled out porcupine skins and the little baby soft quills in Romeo's poops. And he said, well, you know, Southeast wolves, some of them really get good at it. And they must grab them by the face, which has no quills on them, kill them with a good quick bite, and it might take some positioning. And then they lay them on their back and eat them from the belly outward, and there's no quills on the belly.
That's amazing. That's like the mongoose and the cobra, for Pete's sake.
Yeah. And of course, Romeo, like all good Southeast Alaska wolves, ate a hell of a lot of fish. As a matter of fact, his appearance in the late summer coincided with different early runs. I mean, he'd show up at the places where the first pinks came in and rotate around. And other people confirmed that you'd see him at certain places where there were, you know, there was an early run of pinks or chums. And I found fish bones and scales and stuff in his scats well into the winter because, of course, you know, you can eat some pretty stinky fish that wouldn't appeal to us, but to a wolf or a dog is just fine. And I also do think that he pinched a goat or a deer now and then. I think he traveled pretty widely and ended up out at Amalga when sometimes the deer get pushed down toward tidewater in the winter. I don't know of anybody who systematically fed the wolf. If you tell me that he I don't know of anybody.
There was one other question that I had too that might be kind of interesting for the listeners, and that is I don't know if you mentioned, I haven't read your book yet, but at one time, you know, we were concerned as an agency about how this was all going to end up. And then, you know, we actually got more and more comfortable with it as time went by. But then there were a couple of other wolves appeared that associated with Romeo for a very short time. And, you know, then we became more concerned. But apparently that was a very ephemeral thing. And Romeo either rejected those wild wolves or they just went on their way. Do you know any more about that?
I do. I happen to be right there. Living on the lake shore had its advantages, and so when other wolves started howling, we could hear them inside the house. But I happened to be out skiing. It was an April day, or maybe it was late March, and we could hear wolves howling up the West Glacier Trail. And it turned out they got a couple of goats down up there in deep snow. I think that's why that pack came down. And I saw Romeo interacting with a gray wolf who was obviously a young male. It wasn't obvious at first, and people go, oh, he found his mate at last. And then, of course, it turns out to be a boy.
Well, now wait a minute.
Yeah, well, you know, it takes all kinds, but I don't. That's always another possibility here. But anyway, it did turn out that that wolf was clearly uncomfortable, and Romeo would lead that other wolf out of the West Glacier Trail little areas that he had out into the lake, and it took about a week. And that wolf got more and more uncomfortable, and you could just see him fidgeting, and he left. And I think he was trying it on for size and just found out it didn't work. I really thought when that pack showed up, I thought Romeo was dead because, of course, interpack strife is such a major source of mortality in wolves in general. You know, it's up to one-third of all mortality is caused by neighboring families hitting on each other like the Gambinis, you know.
Pat, you really opened up the gold mine there with those stories. Thanks.
Yeah, I really appreciate
it. Yeah, well, you're welcome. And thanks, Nick, for writing the book. I was hoping that you would do that, and I'm looking forward to reading it.
Well, thanks, and you can please feel free to let me know where I slipped up. I tried to run it past some good researchers, and I'm sure that there are some things I can learn.
Yeah.
Well, as you probably know, you know, anything you say about wolves will be controversial in one way or another, so I don't think I'm going to be very critical.
Well, one thing I will say is that I thought that ADFG's management of this wolf was absolutely remarkable and exemplary, not because they kept their hands off, but because they monitored it and really were paying attention in just the right way, and I thought took the right steps at the right times. And the Forest Service did too. It's really hard to find another example of two agencies co-managing a wild predatory animal that's living right on the edge of people and sometimes in their backyards. It's just phenomenal.
Pat, I want to thank you again for your call.
I wouldn't be surprised if there have been other cases of a wolf trying to react like that, but the problem is most people just are not in a position to recognize that kind of wolf behavior. If something like that happens in a village or some other area, it's very likely that the wolf would not survive. So that, I think it was just kind of a happy coincidence that sort of thing happened in Juneau, you know, with the kind of people that frequented Mendenhall Lake and all of that kind of thing. So I think that was quite fortunate.
All right. Thanks a lot, Pat. Thanks for your call. And our guest is Nick Jans, author of A Wolf Called Romeo, as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station.
The Medallion Foundation and the Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports and provide services to the flying public. Passengers are influential in making flying safer in Alaska. When passengers know their rights and responsibilities, aviation is safer for everyone. Safety information online at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
I think it's fair to say that Nick Jans's book, A Wolf Called Romeo, gives you plenty to think about our relationship with animals. And I don't know that he's got the answers even, but he's thought about it a lot, and he's brought us the benefit of that thought and the recounting of the many experiences he and Sherry and their friends had with this wolf, who was mostly really interested in their dogs, but would also kind of tolerate people in the Mendenhall Valley for a period of years, for a rather long period of years, longer than many wolves live in the wild. The book is called A Wolf Called Romeo, and he's with us by digital link from KTOO in Juneau. We'll be going to Anchorage and Palmer to be signing books later on this week. And Nick, you know, part of this, do you think that part of what happened with Romeo is that he was maybe orphaned a bit young and had to develop his own behaviors? I mean, because wolves, from Gordon Haber's work, they need other wolves to learn from. And this one started out pretty young and kind of on his own. It's not like lone wolves are unknown, but healthy lone wolves are pretty unusual.
Well, here's what we do know, is, according to ADFG records, there were several wolves trapped up in the Nugget Basin, which was only several miles away, the winter before Romeo appeared. Okay, and also a pregnant female, who is also a black wolf, was hit by a taxi about a mile and a half from the Glacier Visitor Center, between there and our house, actually. And when she was hit and killed, witnesses heard howling in the woods. And people started glimpsing a black wolf in that area late that summer. And, of course, late that fall, the wolf was in full view. And so he certainly could have been a survivor of a pack. And that's one of the possibilities I posit. But there are other explanations. The other thing is that he fit the profile for a dispersing wolf. That's just a wolf that splits off from a pack. It's basically, again, a family group, if you want to call it, a pack, whatever you want to call it, is mom, dad, and the kids, and maybe Uncle Ernie and Aunt Louise thrown in sometimes. But mostly it's a nuclear family. And late teenage, young adult wolves leave home, just like we hope our own offspring do, and we hope they don't end up in the basement playing video games. So he fit that profile as well. And it's also been, that's really common, actually, for single wolves. They have to do that. That's how they split up, and that's how they disperse. And they're very, very good at it and cover huge distances sometimes to do that. So we really don't know. And, you know, I have to say this is, I ask a lot of questions, and when I don't have answers, all I can do is posit the possibilities. And what I love most about this wolf was all I didn't know about him, not what I knew.
Let's go to a few more callers here. Where Donald joins the program from Fairbanks again. Welcome to Talk of Alaska, Donald, with Nick Jans.
Hi, Steve and Nick. Real quick comment for you. I may not be adding much to the conversation, but I've enjoyed kind of your discussion on relationship with wild animals. And I think I just want to make a comment that I'm still continually surprised at some of the research that pops up where scientists suddenly, you know, quotes, discover that a certain species or a certain animal can display or show signs of being able to display certain emotions. And, you know, a relationship with any animal, and we can see it in dogs, involves emotions. And so I think it's interesting that as humans, we've been kind of slow to accept the fact that, yeah, animals do have emotions and can display those emotions. And then I just thought I'd also second your comments on the porcupine carcasses I found where wolves have killed porcupines in the Brooks Range as well. And it actually just looks like a human skinned them out into a rug. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah. No, I've seen it a few times in the Brooks Range. I never, back then in those days, I never attributed it to wolves. I just found the flayed pieces and wondered what happened to the porcupine.
Well, who ate that?
That's
quite a piece of work.
but wolves are pretty much, they're opportunists. And while they certainly have animals they recognize as prey, and some of them become very much specialists, they also don't like passing up an easy meal. And all you got to do is unwrap the riddle there with the porcupine. And boy, you've got a pretty tasty little fat treat there.
All right. Yeah, thanks for that. Let's go to Mary, joins the program from Anchorage. You're on Talk of Alaska with Nick Jans.
Thank you very much. I've read the book. I've raised and trained dogs for about 40 years, and the dogs and the wolves are so similar. It's amazing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, it really is. I have Skipper Keys. It's an oddball breed. And I recognized a great deal of my dogs in Romeo.
Yeah, that doesn't surprise me at all. Again, remember that the genetic similarity is 99.98%. And granted, that 0.2% must loom huge between a Skipper Key and a 120-pound black wolf, you know, but...
Well, 100 pounds for one thing.
right. But what's interesting about of course, wild canids is how malleable they are, right? Is how we can shape them to all these different things. It's such a huge gene pool there. And so, you know, if we want to work on breeding something in, surely we can do it in just a few generations and create these custom breeds. And you know, one thing that's interesting about, of course, a black wolf, which is very common, relatively common in Alaska and pretty rare in Asia and Europe, as I understand it, is that black wolf color phase is a genetic marker of interbreeding with Native American dogs long ago. I'm not talking about recent, but it's been a biofeedback loop. It's been going back and forth, which is one of the questions or comments that Bob there in Prince of Wales brought up too. It's the same deal. Is that it's hard to say exactly what a purebred wolf is sometimes.
Mary, I want to thank you for your call and try and get one more in. Lou from Ketchikan might bear on this. Lou, welcome to Talk of Alaska. Just got a minute or so.
Good morning. I'm looking at Stephen Jay Gould's book about entitled Ever Since Darwin, and he posits that evolution is bursts, not a steady change. Could this behavior of this wolf have been one of those behavioral evolutionary bursts where, and that had happened in the past, and it was some animal like that became the domesticated dog? And thank you. Great show.
Well, heck, I would say why not? I mean, that's exactly what I think was going on. Again, Mother Nature loves to roll dice. And when you get something that really moves forward, you have this sort of, 2001 A Space Odyssey moment, right? You know, where the hominids all of a sudden start realize they have tools in their hands and the monolith comes up. You know, that was a dramatization of this very thing happening.
Lou?
Thank you very much. That's just the sort of info I was looking for. Great show.
Yeah, that's great. You know, Nick, this is one of the most fun subjects there is. I just have to say that I've had Ted Carasotti on a couple of times and carried on about this. I never got Gordon Haber on, but I got Mary Beth to talk about his work, and now you're adding yours. Are you going to keep writing about animals? You're sort of on a roll now.
Well, I've always written about animals, tell you the truth. I actually came to Alaska in 1979 figuring I was going to be a wolf and bear biologist. That's what I wanted to do.
Okay, well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Nick Jans, author of A Wolf Called Romeo, joined us by a digital link from KTOO in Juneau. Thanks very much to them. Thanks also to Pat Yak and... Yes, I lost my notes. Oh, man. Sorry, Dave Waldron, and I'm Steve Heimel. Thanks for listening.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by
ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you've served in the military, the Alaska VA welcomes you home and thanks you for your service. We encourage you to enroll for VA health care benefits. Go to 1010ez.med.va.gov to apply online in less than 5 minutes, or print, fax, or mail the 2-page form to the VA. You do not need your DD-214 to apply. Call 257-3323 for questions. This message is sponsored by the VA. This program is a production of APRN, which is solely responsible for its content. The views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at alaskapublic.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.